From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. And here's a viewer on CNN last Wednesday.
Can somebody tell me why they aren't handing out pitchforks right now and we are not charging AIG headquarters en masse?
A new Gallup poll conducted Tuesday finds that 59% of the people are outraged at the AIG bonuses. Another 26% say they're bothered. The outraged have it 2-1. Rage, it seems, is all the rage. Here's AIG CEO Edward Liddy in a House committee room Wednesday reading a choice piece of recent AIG email.
All the executives and their families should be executed with piano wire around their necks.
Liddy said he was worried for the safety of the AIG bonus recipients. House Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank, who wanted their names, said he wasn't persuaded. Not him or anyone else, it seems. On Capitol Hill, the people's representatives were representing all week long. We could demonstrate with a tape montage of angry legislators, but that's so been done. Let's just say that outrage is in the House. And the Senate. Here's Iowa Senator Charles Grassley with a helpful hint on how AIG executives could have improved their image.
If they'd followed the Japanese example and come before the American people and take that deep bow and say, I'm sorry, and then either do one of two things, resign or go commit suicide. And in the case of the Japanese, they usually commit suicide before they make any apology.
It was a bipartisan rage-a-rama until it became a partisan rage-off when some Republicans suggested the nation's top Democrat was insincere in his expression of outrage. This put White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs in the ridiculous position of verifying that the smoke coming out of the president's ears wasn't fake special effects smoke, but real outraged citizen smoke, as real as anyone else's.
I don't think anybody on Capitol Hill should doubt the genuineness of the outrage.
Then the president himself weighed in, claiming that the Republicans' outrage was not only phony, but hypocritical.
There are a whole bunch of folks now who are feigning outrage about these bonuses that a year ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago said, well, we should never meddle in these compensation plans. These are the best and the brightest. They know what they're doing. That's part of the market. And now suddenly they're outraged.
On the brink of Armageddon, an argument over who's more upset. It was like something out of Dr. Strangelove.
I'm sorry too, Dimitri. I'm very sorry. All right, you're sorrier than I am, but I am sorry as well. I am as sorry as you are, Dimitri. Don't say that you're more sorry than I am, because I'm capable of being just as sorry as you are. So we're both sorry, all right? All right.
Just to point out, the way that movie ended was with the world's destruction. So where to turn for perspective on this stuff? Where to get beyond the partisan sniping and political opportunism for some introspection and common sense? Not as we've seen to the corridors of power, not to the collapsed temples of Wall Street. Nah, this was a job for cable? CNN's Campbell Brown.
Guys, get it together, please. We don't need you to feel our pain. We need you to fix this problem, minus the histrionics. Leave that to cable news. Instead, how about you focus on what you're going to do when it is time to write AIG yet another check?
Leave that to cable news. Yep, cable turned the outrage up to 11. Leading the charge last week in righteous indignation was Comedy Central's Jon Stewart. But wait, he doesn't really have anything to do with this mess. He's not running for cover. In his much-YouTubed interview with CNBC's Mad Money man Jim Cramer, he was just sincerely outraged.
It feels like we are capitalizing your adventure by our pension and our money, and that it is a game that you know is going on, but that you go on television as a financial network and pretend isn't happening.
The money man cowered before the funny man and conceded that CNBC had engaged in some unseemly financial cheerleading. But Thursday on the Today Show with Meredith Vieira, Cramer bravely said that he didn't mean it.
I don't want to rehash the whole thing, but did he have a point? I don't think so.
Kramer said CNBC had done a lot of great reporting.
So you don't think the media bears any responsibility, Jim?
I think that there are people who would bear so much more responsibility that it's just wrongheaded. The politicians, the regulators, the SEC, the lenders, the investment banks. I mean, we're listening to AIG. I mean, you're going to compare the media to AIG. There's some people who really should get in line to really take the responsibility. And the media, it's just a naive focus. It really is, Murph.
It really isn't, Jim. A media critic keeping his eye on the conduct of media isn't naive. It's his reason for existing, much as you'd imagine a financial news network exists to keep an eye on Wall Street, as opposed to shilling for it. If that happens once, shame on you. If it happens twice, well, that's an outrage. Brooke?
Jim Rutenberg has long covered media for the New York Times. Jim, I want to read you something from a story. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. When the market shot up, CNBC found itself accused of being Wall Street's loudest public address system. Its blanket business coverage, it was said, gave voice to too many bulls, letting too many fund managers promote questionable stocks in which they held positions, and allowed too many analysts to talk up new companies they were being paid to cover. The date on that is March 26, 2001.
It had a nice ring to it.
Okay, so you were covering CNBC in its golden period right before the tech bubble burst and then right after. Have you recently felt an unsettling sense of deja vu?
You know, it's so funny because I had forgotten all about that piece, but something has been nagging at me, and I've been saying to myself, wow, this feels so familiar, this feels so familiar. And I totally forgot that we'd been through this once before. I have a feeling I'm not alone, and that might be why we are here again.
Yeah, well, I guess the big question for me is, you know, when the tech bubble burst in 2001, most of the big magazines that were covering it folded, but CNBC survived. And in the midst of this current recession, their CEO, Jeff Zucker, responded to the criticism of the network by saying that the audience ratings had been bolstered by the recession. Why aren't there consequences for CNBC being wrong?
There really weren't consequences. And I would predict that there won't be consequences should we go through yet another cycle like this down the road. People, when they're making money and watching those green arrows go up, don't want to hear about potential red ahead. And so for a network like CNBC, it gets a whole new slate, a brand new slate. It's all forgotten until it isn't.
But there are some differences between now and then. I mean, for instance, back in 2001, there were fewer blogs, fewer media watchdog groups. Jon Stewart didn't have the same status. There were fewer people overall policing the media. Do you think that the landscape has changed sufficiently since the tech bubble, that accountability has increased, or is that a ridiculous question to be asking after everything we've seen?
Certainly, there's a lot more attention being brought to it this time. This story that you and I were just talking about from 2001, it was on the cover of our business page. It was picking up some chatter out there in the ether, but nothing like the kind of crescendo right now running against CNBC and these financial journalists. But one thing that goes along with those blogs and the new media atmosphere is that attention spans are shorter than ever. And if people start making money again in the next couple of years and CNBC reverts, it will be forgotten. Mark my words.
Do you think networks like CNBC are extra resistant to consequences for bad calls because nothing makes people want to tune in more than money?
The audience that watches CNBC has a direct investment in what CNBC is covering. So no matter what, there's a built-in interest. Now, when your investments start going down, that interest will slacken off. You don't want to watch the bad news. That said, when they watch it going up again, they want to believe it because it's their money. It's has direct impact on them. But this kind of is a cable news phenomenon in general. How many political pundits went out there every day over the course of the presidential campaign and made an incorrect call only to show up again the next day to make a new bold call that ended up being wrong often? So cable news is a sort of alternative reality when it comes to predictions.
I don't know. It just reminds me of, you know, Homer Simpson. He steps on the broom and it hits him in the head and he goes, ow. Uh-huh. Then he does it again and he goes, ow. Then he does it again and goes, ow.
Yeah, well, I can't argue with you. Doh.
Jim. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Jim Rutenberg is a staff writer for The New York Times.
The rest of this show is devoted to new and easier ways to get a ruined reputation than fostering an economic meltdown. You don't have to do anything if you get in someone's crosshairs online. Because the people who post libelous slurs are anonymous, and the websites that host them immune from prosecution.
To create a legal regime under which Google had an obligation to check all of the content on those 1 trillion websites and have a lawyer determine whether it might defame somebody would essentially mean that you couldn't have a search engine.
Is posting public records of who has a permit to carry a gun a violation of privacy or news you can use? Should a person have to sign their online restaurant reviews? If a doctor won't treat you unless you agree not to write about him online, should you sign or walk? And what's the line between free speech and a free-for-all when you're posting on the net?
Quite often you can get a powder keg where people do tend to vent, they do tend to flame.
People with no names and no faces can be pretty ugly. Coming up, Bad Moon Rising on the Internet.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Public information is a lot more public than it used to be. Online, you can rummage through everything from restaurant health inspection reports to records of political donations. Still, it can be a bit of an expedition. Records are largely decentralized and hard to access. So, in a bid to draw more online readers, many newspapers are assembling those public records under one roof: the paper's website. The Commercial Appeal in Memphis, Tennessee is one such paper. Its online data center is exhaustive, and last December it added a database of everyone in the state who has a permit to carry a handgun. The NRA and many gun owners protested that this violated their right to privacy. But Chris Peck, the paper's editor, says in this case there are good reasons why privacy should take a back seat to the free flow of information. This is news his readers can use.
They might have a kid who was thinking about going overnight for a sleepover, and a parent might say, gee, I wonder if there's a gun in the house. And we had many people who perhaps had protective orders against an ex-spouse or boyfriend use the list from time to time to see if the person who was under the protective order had a gun. So there was all variety of reasons, but the core reason was this was a public record that we felt could be useful to people in making decisions in their daily lives.
So you put up the data in December, and a huge backlash happened in February. What happened?
We had a situation in Memphis where two men got an argument about whether their SUVs were parked too close to one another. And one of the men went to his vehicle, got a gun, and came back and shot and killed the other man in the midst of the argument. So then in the course of reporting about the shooting, we made a very small reference in print to the fact that we had the database online, had been online for months, and that, in fact, the person who was involved in the shooting had a permit to carry. And at that point, what happened was the NRA and other pro-gun groups in Tennessee and elsewhere around the country launched a very intense national campaign accusing us of violating people's privacy, of endangering people.
Specifically, the NRA said that the database on your site was hateful and shameful. It was a form of public irresponsibility and the collapse of responsible media.
Those were some of the nicer things that we heard from the most ardent pro-gun supporters. And we certainly would take seriously concerns that the NRA had raised. And we made it very clear that we were pro-Second Amendment. but that we were also pro-First Amendment. And we felt there was a very strong case to be made that the balance needed to be struck between access of these records and also the accountability in government.
So after all the negative attention, you launched a campaign to show why the database is necessary.
We really hadn't done a lot of reporting using the database until this all blew up. And what we discovered was there were more than 600 people in the state of Tennessee who had felony convictions or other violent criminal acts who had a permit. And the point we wanted to make was that's the reason the records need to be open, is that people who are carrying, have permits to carry, need to be responsible gun owners. And we agree with the NRA on that point. And that really is the crux of the issue.
Nevertheless, you've been bombarded with emails from pro-gun rights proponents. At one point, you said you were getting 600 of them a day.
This became a cause that really got way, way beyond the particular issues here in Tennessee. Many of the gun groups posted the names, the addresses, and the photographs of my children on their pro-gun websites, the names, addresses, and maps to houses of our publisher. It came to a point where we did have to get 24-hour protection at our residences because of the vitriol that was being expressed over the posting of the database.
The NRA has taken advantage of this backlash to push through some legislation. One bill that's being considered in the Tennessee legislature would make it a criminal offense to publish these records. In effect, it would make you take the website down. Where does this bill stand?
The issue of whether to criminalize the posting of the records has been delayed, and we're not sure exactly what's going on there, although it does appear that there are some people who are uncomfortable in the legislature with the idea of making it a criminal offense to reveal the name of someone who was on the list. And one of the issues that I think is getting traction with some gun owners is this. If you if the NRA and others succeed in closing off the list to the public, what you then have created, of course, is a secret list of gun owners in Tennessee that only the government has. And many of these folks who are so adamant about this permit to carry issue are equally adamant about not wanting to have the government be too intrusive or involved in their lives. So the irony and the paradox of all this is that Tennessee is on the verge of creating a secret list of people who won't have guns that only the government can see. And again, I think that has caused, at least in the cooler heads, a little bit of thought about whether you in fact want to completely close off this list.
So what have you learned from this whole big brouhaha?
I mean, one of the things that I heard often from people and when I looked at their emails was say, the real thing that I don't like about this list being posted on your website is first, it gives criminals a way to get to my house. And then the second thing was the phrase, it takes away my advantage. And when you think about it, what that says is there's a sense that we are, you know, a hair's breadth away from having to pull that gun out and defend myself. And I think living in that world and the intensity of those feelings were really sobering.
Chris, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Chris Peck is editor of the Commercial Appeal, a daily newspaper in Memphis, Tennessee.
It's a classic device in sitcoms and movies. The characters who run a restaurant or a hotel catch word that a famous critic is coming to review their business in, for instance, Twin Peaks.
Wentz travels incognito. Nobody can trace his identity.
Favorable Wentz review could be quite useful.
Well, he's coming. He's coming. He's coming.
Keep an
he's
eye on registration.
Business owners no longer need to freak out guessing because now every customer could write the review that defines the restaurant. For good or for bad. All of this is made possible, of course, by an array of websites that crowdsource the reviewing process to ordinary people. Chief among them, Yelp, a website that started in 2004 in San Francisco and since has spread to 24 cities with more than 5 million reviews posted to the site. Those reviews praise and bash every last business from restaurant to nail salon. Jeremy Stoppelman is Yelp co-founder and CEO, and he joins me now. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Jeremy, where did the idea for Yelp come from?
We realized that people typically found new businesses searching on the internet And there must be a better way than simply browsing advertisements. And so what popped into our head was, you know, a really good way to find a local business is to ask around, to ask friends for recommendations. And what we tried to create was a place where you could tap into word of mouth online.
You know, we've all read about the wisdom of the crowds, but how do we know that those who go to a restaurant can give us anything worthwhile by way of opinion? Food critics have, you know, some sort of expertise, haven't they?
Food critics have a very precise palate. What most people realize is sometimes they don't necessarily agree with that one perspective. What Yelp provides is the opinions of many. You can browse around, read all the different reviews that you want until you get your fill. And then when you find a reviewer that has a perspective that sounds interesting, you can actually click on that particular profile and learn more about that person.
Is there a secret to reading Yelp reviews so that you don't focus on one particular critic and somehow manage to embrace the commentary as a whole?
Yeah. So when you go to a Yelp page, the first thing you'll notice is the average star rating. So right there, you have a very broad sense of how that business is doing. You also have a number of graphs that you can take a look at. You can see very quickly how many total five-star reviews, how many four-star reviews, how many one-star reviews. And that gives you an overall sense of the big picture. The next thing you'll see on most pages where we have enough reviews to do this, we actually use software to pull out review highlights, the things people are most often talking about. And it's always positive. It focuses on what do you want to check out? What are the best dishes? And then as you move down the page, you'll find the user reviews.
You crunched the numbers and figured out that 35% of Yelpers gave 4 out of 5 stars for any given service. 32% gave 5 out of 5.
If you add it all up, 85% of all reviews are neutral to positive.
Okay, but I'm running Luigi's and Bella Luna, the pizzeria, opens across the street and I'm terrified that they're going to cut into my business. So I, Luigi, and everyone I know goes on to Yelp to start bad-mouthing Bella Luna, driving their number of stars down 5, 4, 3, 2 to, you know, let's say a half a star. Do you have anything, any kind of algorithm that looks for patterns like that to try to root out Yelp fraud?
Absolutely, there are protections in place, both from the software side, as you suggest, algorithms, as well as, you know, very obvious things from the consumer perspective. You can see a given individual's other reviews. And you could see the feedback and awards, essentially, that that person has garnered within the Yelp community. And so as a result, it's very, very difficult to create a personality on Yelp that does not reflect a real person. And that essentially is our foundation. We're not an anonymous review site. Most of the contributors have very deep profiles and reputations on Yelp.
Do you ever delete comments that are just manifestly false? You know, I found a mouse in my soup. I found a finger in my soup. I found a raccoon in my soup. Is there any protection against restaurant slander?
We're not necessarily in a position to determine what exactly happened, and we want to make sure that all individuals feel that they can share their experiences openly. Now, that said, if a business finds something that they feel is clearly outside of our terms of service or our review guidelines, such as you're talking about an experience that you didn't have but maybe a friend did, we absolutely will take a look at that and potentially pull it down.
There are a number of San Francisco restaurateurs who just feel that they've been blindsided by Yelp and that they have no recourse. How do you calm them down?
This is word of mouth. There are people talking, and there's going to be the good with the bad, mostly good. And if you think about yourself, as you might take a look at a Yelp page, you're not necessarily going to hone in on that one stray negative comment. You're going to be reading the review highlights that we call out that show the best things, the specialties of that business, and then you're going to make your decision. While there is going to be the occasional bad review, like there would be for any business, that can actually add credibility. And in fact, The Economist, just this last week, was talking about on Amazon and Google Shopping, they're finding that if there's a little bit of negative feedback, that actually adds credibility to the whole picture. Because who expects a restaurant to be 100% flawless day in and day out with every single possible aspect of the business?
Jeremy, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jeremy Stoppelman is co-founder and CEO of Yelp. So, really, who does expect a business to be 100% flawless? Well, sometimes the business's owner, the person who owns it, founded it, lives with it, and pours his heart and soul into it. Someone like Craig Stoll, who, along with his wife Anne, owns the San Francisco restaurants Delfina and Pizzeria Delfina. Actually, his Yelp reviews are quite positive, usually 4 out of 5 stars. Still, occasionally someone posts a stinker, and that apparently is a serious bummer. So much so that one of their managers suggested they do some Yelping of their own. They took some of the worst Yelp reviews, "This place sucks," for example, and put them on T-shirts, which the wait staff sometimes would wear on the job to the confusion and sometimes delight of customers. Why go to such snarky lengths? Because when Craig Stoll first logged on to Yelp to see what the world was writing about his restaurant,
it was horrible. I think what we feel and what a lot of businesses feel is powerless with these Yelp reviews. You can't respond, you know, short of contacting the person and giving them a gift certificate or, you know, begging forgiveness. There's really no public way to respond. Plus, it could be a lie. You know, they could say, my brother got food poisoning and died, and the waitress insulted me, and the rat ran across the table. And you can call Yelp, and they would say, well, this doesn't violate our terms and conditions. No, we're not taking it off.
Did this experience cause you to do different staff training to change your operations in any material way?
Yes. There have been things pointed out to us that we've changed. You know, we've said, wow, they're absolutely right. Maybe we need to explain that pastas are not meant to be entrees because it's not a huge bowl of pasta. There's a lot of things like that that we've really concentrated on because of the feedback. So it's completely candid comments about the food and service that they might not even give us were they to give us their comments in person.
I want to ask you about what's going on in your head. When trained reviewers come into Delfina, they tend to have very, very nice things to say. They apparently have very good experiences there. They like the food. And the preponderance of the feedback from ordinary mortals on Yelp has been quite positive, right?
Yeah.
But the 20% of nasty stuff just sticks in your craw. Why does it get to you so much?
That's how we are. We celebrate the good, but not as much as we focus on the bad, I guess, you know. It's a public flogging. It stings.
But in your T-shirt stunt, you actually didn't put positive Yelp reviews on them. Why not?
It wasn't the point. The point was to just... It was fun for the staff. The staff, too, they read these things. They get really upset, and they'll be like, I waited on that guy last night. He was asking for pineapple on his pizza, and then now he's complaining about the quality of our mozzarella. What that guy's, you know, or, you know, I know his pizza took a little longer, but Jesus Christ, it didn't take 3 hours. I know it didn't take 3 hours. They get more upset than we do.
Do you continue to go on to Yelp to see what users are having to say?
I stopped going on to Yelp a couple of years ago. I'm just... I can't take it. It just puts me in a bad mood for the entire day. Our managers look at it. My wife, Annie, who I run the business with, audits it pretty regularly.
So on balance, I've got to ask you this. Do you think that this service is good for the San Francisco dining community, or isn't it?
It's a yes or no question, isn't it?
I believe it was, yeah.
Do you think it's good for the... My wife's sitting right here. Do you think Yelp is good for the San Francisco community, dining out community, I should say, or not?
Good.
Overall, I guess. Yeah. Overall, it's good. I mean, it's just people are talking more about restaurants. I hate to say it. I mean, colleagues might shoot me, but I think that people want to know what other people like them think. And to all our, you know, hand-wringing and being upset about this, we... The other day, one of our managers was deciding on where she was going to go and was looking at Yelp reviews of some restaurants, which just cracked me up. In a way, I mean, it's fairly brilliant. It's the future, and there's no getting around it.
Craig, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Craig Stoll is the chef and owner, along with his wife Ann, of Delfina and Pizzeria Delfina in San Francisco.
Coming up, how to wreck a life online.
This is On the Media from NPR.
On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Centre at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If you're hungry and looking for a good meal, the choice you make based on review sites like Yelp is not a matter of life and death. But if you're sick and looking for a doctor, it may well be. Patients are turning to the web to review physicians in ever greater numbers, both their bedside manner and the quality of the medical treatment itself. Many doctors have cried foul, not just because they can't take the heat, they say, but because federal law prohibits them from identifying their patients and thus from responding to their critics online. Into the breach has stepped a group called Medical Justice, which provides physicians with a release for patients to sign that would restrict them from opining about their doctor online. Jeffrey Siegel is a former neurosurgeon and founder of Medical Justice. He says his intention is not to silence patients, but to treat what amounts to an epidemic.
What we are reacting to is a collection of now over 40 mostly anonymous internet rating sites where doctors are forbidden to rebut because of state and federal privacy laws. We think that internet rating sites can be done better. The current crop of rating sites fail, and what the waiver is designed to do is to create a mechanism to allow us to pause and get it done right.
How many people have signed it?
We have 2,000 physician plan members. Each doctor probably sees anywhere between 1,000 and 3,000 patients a year. I don't know the exact number, but it is a big number.
Now, in your literature, you state the reasons for this waiver or release. First, you say that the information on these sites is medically unhelpful at best or irresponsible at worst. We looked at a few of these sites, and a lot of the reviews, actually most of them, read like this. You know, always runs late, unorganized, interruptions from nurse, distracted, slow with test results. That's one of 56 reviews for a doctor on ratemds.com. What's the harm in that?
We have no problem with a patient saying a doctor is a jerk. If there are 50 patients that say the doctor is a jerk, pretty good odds the doctor is a jerk. Where we struggle is when people start defining quality of care, something that is a little bit different than rating plumbing or roofing. On occasion, someone feels as if they've been treated badly because of bad customer service, for lack of a better word. And other times, they feel as if they've been treated badly because of their perception the quality of care was poor. Now, these sites conflate those two into one.
It seems extraordinary that a doctor would ask a patient to not express their opinion in advance of providing service.
It's our argument that in 2009, because of how pervasive these sites are and how damaging they can be to reputations, we would like to see a reframing of the discussion to figure out how we can do it better. Number one, many of the sites are anonymous, so what we'd like to do is verify that the patient is indeed a patient. Number two, we would like to see a minimum collection of comments before they go public. We know some sites are doing that. We'd like to see more comments be aggregated before they go public. And number three, limit the commentary to subjective impressions as opposed to technical details. If indeed you want to post technical details, it needs to be backed up by some type of expert evaluation.
Well, let's talk about the technical knowledge, the patient's perception of the care that they're getting. Doctors say patients really can't begin to judge the quality of complex medical care. Now, many patients say that this is a way that doctors have always shirked any oversight that doesn't suit them. They hide behind technicalities which are opaque. Is there some middle ground on this issue?
Doctors need to take the lead, I think, in defining what is quality of care. I don't think we should throw our hands up in the air and say we never will be able to do it. I think we will be able to do it. But there are some differences between defining what's good in healthcare and what's good about a roofer or a plumber. First, medicine is not a spectator sport. I mean, you have participants. So if the doctor tells the patient, this is what I think you ought to do to get healthy, the patient is an active player in this. Number two, healthcare is not only delivered by one individual, it's delivered by a system, and care is often fragmented, and often patients don't even know who their doctor is. And number three, care is delivered over a continuum of time. We don't really know the true result until a fair amount of time has passed. And then fourth and finally, not all patients are equal, and some patients have greater risk factors. It's more difficult to compare apples to apples. I've defined how hard it is. I haven't said it can't be done. I just said it's very difficult, but it must be done.
I know that you've said that this isn't a gag order, that a patient can go to another doctor if he or she doesn't want to sign the waiver, but it certainly feels like one.
Patients are free to communicate to friends, family, other doctors, medical licensing boards, peer review committees. We believe that because there are so many rating sites out there, overall they've done more harm than good. We are free speech advocates. We would like to see responsible speech, and the mere fact that we're having this conversation, I think, is getting us closer to the point where some of the more credible sites will self-police. Once we get to that point where there's a credible site, we think the other sites that have no credibility will just be graffiti and noise.
All right. Dr. Siegel, thank you very much.
Thanks kindly.
Dr. Jeffrey Siegel is the Chief Executive Officer and founder of Medical Justice.
Through your Explorer toolbar, Microsoft knows your every keystroke. Your EasyPass and your GPS cell phone monitor your whereabouts and record them. Your financial details and health information are data files somewhere, most likely many somewheres. Your purchases are tracked at the supermarket checkout, and Google serves you online ads based on the content of your personal Gmail. It's downright creepy if you think about it. If Big Brother were interested in you personally, you'd have nowhere to hide.
We are one people, with one will, one resolve, one cause.
But on that point, I've got some good news for you. Big Brother isn't much interested in you personally. Every marketer in America is extremely interested in your IP address, which tells them what the consumer at your computer is likely to buy. But unless you get in the government's crosshairs, the chances of you, the actual person, being victimized by the powers that be are quite remote. But here's the bad news. In a connected world, there are 6 billion little brothers.
The Orwellian literary landscape imagines a universe that made sense at the time it was written, which is to say there is a concentrated amount of power in a central authority figure, and that central authority is the hub around which the rest of us are spokes.
Michael Furtick is founder of the Internet privacy service Reputation Defender.
We now see that the world is one in which there are many, many hubs and many spokes.
Millions of blogs, websites, and comment boards provide millions of opportunities for someone to insult you, to float rumors about you, tell lies about you, reveal secrets about you, post compromising photos of you, and otherwise make your life a living hell. You have very little to fear from 1984, but every reason to quake about Lord of the Flies. Anyone who frequents sports websites, or politics, or classical music for that matter, knows that the anonymity and physical distance of internet communication can lead otherwise civilized people to barbarism and cruelty. the online disinhibition effect, it's called.
So, some research we did out of my lab found that when people are communicating online, they tend to become more focused on themselves, which means they're more focused on their attitudes and emotions.
Adam Joynton is a professor of psychology at England's University of Bath.
And if you combine that with a lack of concern about the person you're talking to, not being aware of their reaction and their response, then quite often you can get a powder keg where people do tend to vent, they do tend to flame.
The rage manifests itself in various ways and creates various categories of victims. Websites such as dumponyou.com and Revenge World exist for the very purpose of character assassination. Many celebrity websites are e-tabloids, hungering to embarrass the rich and famous.
I don't give a damn that you're 12 years old or 11 years old, or that you're a child, or that your mother is a thoughtless pain in the ass. You have humiliated me for the last time with this phone.
When Alec Baldwin's angry voicemail to his daughter showed up online, the actor was excoriated. When skanky pictures of American Idol contestant Antonella Barba appeared, she was briefly the most Googled woman in the world, but nothing to do with her singing. They, of course, sought the spotlight only to get more than they bargained for. Not so Ghislaine Raza, the chubby teenager known worldwide as the Star Wars kid. He was victimized by classmates who came upon a videotape of his Darth Maul lightsaber routine and, without his permission, posted it online. Because of Ghislaine's unheroic appearance and because his lightsaber was actually a telescoping golf ball retriever, he's been laughed at more than a billion times worldwide, making him the most ridiculed of all ridiculed fat kids in human history. And then there was Megan Meyer. She was a 13-year-old Missouri girl who made a fast friend on MySpace only to have that sweet, cute 16-year-old Josh turn on her, ridicule her, tell her the world would be better without her. Only after Megan committed suicide was it revealed that Josh was an invented character created by two adults to intentionally crush her. Yes, for all its revolutionary benefits, the internet is also a malice engine. The men's room wall writ unimaginably large, but with one devastating difference. You can scrub the bathroom wall. Google just crawls the web and brings back what it finds from wherever and whenever. Search for someone who has been defamed ever and up the slander pops, because a search engine can't distinguish between truth and falsity, much less malice and goodwill.
Google just passed 1 trillion websites it indexes with its search engine.
Mark Lemley is a professor of law at Stanford University.
To create a legal regime under which Google had an obligation to check all of the content on those 1 trillion websites and have a lawyer determine whether it might defame somebody would essentially mean that you couldn't have a search engine.
Lemley gets that, but he also represents 2 former Yale law students, Britton Heller and Heidi Iravani, who were repeatedly viciously targeted by anonymous online critics on a law school admissions discussion board called AutoAdmit.com. The women were falsely accused of everything from sexual impropriety to heroin addiction to cheating, and were subject to lascivious speculation of the most graphic and sometimes violent kind by dozens of unknown attackers. David Margalik wrote about the case in this month's Portfolio magazine.
In Britton Heller's case, somebody who knew her as an undergraduate posted something anonymously saying, "Hey, Yaleys, Britton Heller is going to be in your entering class. Watch out for her." Heidi Iravani got involved because one of her classmates posted a picture of her and started commenting on her breast size. And then everybody starts jumping and pouncing in and contributing to the degeneration. It became a kind of cyber free-for-all.
With consequences beyond humiliation. Heller says she was turned down by the first 16 law firms she approached for job interviews because, she was certain, Google searches returned results from AutoAdmit besmirching her every which way. And here's where it gets ironic. 2 law students victimized on a website for law students found themselves stymied by the law. Heller asked AutoAdmit to remove the offensive postings, but the proprietors refused, citing the First Amendment. The women asked Google to take down the defamatory posts from its search results, but Google also refused, citing federal law. Under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, web entities cannot be held responsible for defamation or libel perpetrated by users. Lawyer Mark Lemley.
That immunity provision doesn't have a counterpart in the physical world. It was created, I think, because of one of the significant differences between the internet and the physical world, which is the sheer volume of information that can be posted on these electronic equivalents of bulletin boards.
Thus, Congress granted blanket immunity to everyone but the author of libelous or defamatory content. If you've been slimed online and you want justice, you've got to take it up with the slimer. Heller and Iravani attempted just that by filing John Doe lawsuits and subpoenaing AutoAdmit for the identities of their harassers. But under the protection of Section 230, David Margalik explains, AutoAdmit had scrubbed its servers of the data that could connect IP addresses to those posts.
So the women could identify a grand total of only five or six of them, and most of them they identified because they, at one time or another, gave away information that identified who they were.
So does the Communications Decency Act need a do-over? It was passed, after all, in 1996, while the Internet was in its infancy. Privacy hawks say no. Kurt Upsall is senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
We, as a society, have taken a bet that it would be better to have a lot of different voices rather than have the law or the courts decide which voices can come forward.
For one thing, he says, this country has always had rude ad hominem speech, clear back to the founders. Furthermore, he says, as some courts have ruled, readers know how to look at salacious material in context. DumpOnYou.com isn't exactly the congressional record.
A lot of these sites, it's hard to find them very credible. You know, if you see somebody say that so-and-so is a criminal on a site that is filled with hyperbole and bile, how much credence should you really give it? Not much.
But Google reports results entirely out of context. Ask Britton Heller, who sued her tormentors, hired Reputation Defender, and still must live with a Google results page that has, as item number five, is Britton Heller a lying bitch? To Michael Furtick, this screams for a revision in the law, one that would give targets of character assassination at least as much protection as the Digital Millennium Copyright Act confers upon intellectual property owners. Under that law, a website is under no liability if it takes down copyrighted content at the written request of the copyright holder.
Now, under this comparative set of regimes, NBC can send one letter to YouTube and force it to remove 50,000 videos, as happened.
But if someone photoshops you into Nazi regalia or worse, then posts it all over the internet with your name and address attached, well, that's just hard cheese. Yes, under current law, a Saturday Night Live skit is afforded more protection than you are. Still, Upsall of the Electronic Frontier Foundation worries that giving privacy the same status as copyright would encourage anybody whose feelings get bruised, especially government officials, to inundate websites with demands to take down unflattering material, even truthful unflattering material. But Furtick says that's silly.
We could require, for example, that anyone who believes himself or herself to be defamed to file an affidavit saying that, to the best of my knowledge, this is totally false, and to be penalized under penalty of perjury if his or her own claim, filed in front of a clerk of the court, turns out to be false. It's not like the alternative to the status quo is totalitarianism. It's not true. It's false. It's wrong. There are 100 steps between where we are today and a scenario in which we really chill speech. So I suggest we take 3 steps down that primrose path, not 100.
Or else, never mind what Andy Warhol said, in the future, everyone will be defamed in perpetuity. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with help from Cara Gianfrido, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.